Welcome. Carol, your turn.
Okay, I'm Carol Erdahl, and we're supposed to introduce ourselves to you at the beginning of each of these sessions. I'm married to Lowell Erdahl, and that's part of my life. Another part of my life, I'm a children's librarian in an elementary school, and I spend a lot of my time working with these little people, trying to help them catch some of the joy of reading and some of the marvelous things that are available to them there. Lowell and I have three children who are pretty well grown. They were with us the last time we were here, but we have entered into that empty nest part of our relationship together. Our children have left to go to college, and some of them have completed college and are now on their own. And my home is in New Jersey originally, and I laugh as people talk about now we come from Minneapolis. They say, another one from Minneapolis? And I find myself reaching back into my early life to identify myself with someplace other than the Midwest. But I tell you that because it, I think, it helps us to understand sometimes the things that we bring to life and to marriage are oftentimes determined by where we grew up in the first place. So that's who I am.
And I'm Lowell Erdahl, married to Carol, and I am one of the pastors of the University Lutheran Church of Hope in Minneapolis. Taught for a number of years at Luther Seminary and was parish pastor before that. They say that an expert is a person a long ways from home, so we're probably far enough away from home to claim that. An expert is also a person who's written a book on a subject, and Carol and I have written a little book that is related to the subject of building intimacy in marriage and in friendship. And that little book is entitled Be Good to Each Other, an Open Letter on Marriage. This book actually began as a long letter that we sent to Carol's nephew and bride on the occasion of their marriage several years ago. They were married out in Richmond, Virginia, and we couldn't get there. So we sent them the book that is here, not the whole book. When we submitted it for publication, the publisher said, that's a long letter, but it's a short book. Would you please expand it? So we did that.
Today what we would like to do is just talk a little bit with you about intimacy in marriage. And oftentimes whenever you use the word intimate, everybody right away thinks of sexual relations. That has come to be the way we refer to that. But we would like to think of intimacy not only in terms of our sexual relations, but also that whole intimacy that we share in a loving, caring relationship with another person. Jess Lehrer has said in his book that the closest intimacy is when we share what's in our deepest heart, what is really closest to us, our dreams and our hopes. And we would like to talk in terms of how we can achieve or how we can grow in that kind of an intimate relationship with someone else.
One thing we'd like to stress at the beginning is that intimacy is not just a static kind of thing. I think sometimes we have that image of especially in a marriage relationship, and we'll use illustrations, many of them are related to marriage, but we don't think they're just in marriage. They relate to friendship and all the other kind of close relationships we have in life. But these relationships aren't always so smooth and easygoing. We go through cycles of intimacy. There are times in a marriage, for example, when you feel so close to that person, you wonder, how could I ever have an unkind thought towards such a wonderful person? And then a few hours or maybe even a few minutes go by and you feel like bonking the person over the head. You figure, how in the world could I ever have a kind thought toward that person? And in the hardcover edition of our Be Good to Each Other book, there's a typographical error in a little blurb on the back of the book that said, a most helpful book, etc., in pre-marital counseling. The person had intended to write premarital, but it was so wise and true that it was left that way. In the first section of our book, we say we wish you joy. In the next section, we go on at once to say we promise you trouble. And we think it's helpful to have that kind of a realistic evaluation of the fact that intimacy is not always that smooth and lovey-dovey and all a kind of thing that, as we'll go into this more detail a little later on, it also involves a lot of stress and difficulty along the way.
And we've already got a difficulty because Lowell took my spot.
Is that your spot?
Yes. And we kind of divide this up
that's
when
right.
We go through.
We have notes and we have L and C written in the margin. You take my spot then. You go ahead.
And there are certain things that, you know, as in this intimate kind of relationship, you know, you have to kind of live with some of those things. But I don't know, at that point, I guess the reason why we bring this up is that it's important in any relationship in terms of expectations, that we kind of share our expectations. And it's important that we expect in life, whether it's marriage or anything else, to really understand that any close relationship will have these problems, that there will be joy and there will be suffering. There will be times of anger and real struggle. And in promising people, wishing them joy and promising them trouble, it's not to be negative. Someone accused us of being a bit negative. And we don't mean to say that. I think it's similar to the story of the little prince that we heard this morning, that there were tears when the little prince and the wolf parted. But that does not mean that knowing that, they would choose not to have that relationship. And I think that's important for people looking forward to marriage, people who are in marriage, people in friendship relationships too.
We tell a true story in our little book that occurred of an event that took place many years ago before we were married. An uncle of mine and his wife were celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary, and he gave a little speech in connection with the anniversary party in the basement of the church back home. And he made the comment that it was probably an old joke even at that time. He said that in all these 50 years, Sarah and I have never thought of separation or divorce, but we have thought of murder on a few occasions. And that's probably an old joke, but I think there's wisdom in that. I really think that was helpful preparation of marriage. I think there are some occasions when Carol has been prompted by my improper behavior to think of murder. And I'm glad she hasn't carried that out. But I think it's well for us to be aware of these kind of feelings. We have some friends who, one of them made a comment once that he said, you know, it's terrible to be married. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he went on to talk about the responsibilities and the limitations and the misunderstandings that come into that relationship. Then he also went on to say, it is of course also wonderful to be married. It is the most wonderful relationship of my life. And we've thought of that many times, not only in terms of marriage, but also in terms of life itself. It is both terrible and wonderful to be alive. And as we lead into this matter of thinking about intimacy in friendship and marriage relationships, we think it's helpful to keep that in mind.
The last time we were at Holden, that's 6 years ago, we also were sharing some things about marriage. And there were quite a few people who were sitting in our group who were not married. They had been widowed. And afterwards, this one older lady came up to me and she said, you know, she says, I'm glad I was here. She says, because now when I think back, maybe we didn't have such a bad marriage after all. And I think oftentimes we maybe measure the goodness or the badness of something in terms of the maybe the conflict or the problems. And oftentimes the fact that we have problems means that we do have an intimate relationship, that we're willing to risk with honesty and in our emotions and our feelings. And that maybe is a sign of a good marriage, if you've had that kind of conflict and have been able to deal with it.
Somebody has said that half the troubles in life come from being married and the other half come from being single. And we don't really agree with that. We think that at least half the troubles in life haven't much to do with whether we're married or single. They're human problems we're going to have to deal with, whatever our marital state may happen to be. And so we do try, as we go into this now, to relate this to friendship and all the other kind of close relationships, as well as to marriage. So our question is then, how do we maintain, how do we build the kind of relationships in which intimacy is possible? How is it possible for us to be good to each other? And the title of that little book, incidentally, came from a comment that was made by a gas station attendant to a cousin of mine and his wife as they were just on the first day of their honeymoon trip and their car was all painted up. They pulled into a gas station, and as they were leaving, this guy put his head in the door and said, now you be good to each other. And they said he thought that was worth more than what they heard from the preacher. So we've borrowed that as the title of our little book.
I think the first thing we would like to say is that to have intimacy in any relationship requires equality of the two people in a relationship. In any kind of situation where you have a person who is one up on the other person, you cannot have true intimacy. You cannot have true intimacy between a master and a slave, between an employer and an employee, if that relationship might be a good relationship, it might be a fine working relationship, but it will not be an intimate relationship unless the two people are equal. And I think that's important, especially in marriage. And I think that if we are going to share, we have to share with a person who is equal to us or with us. We're not teaching another person. We're not taking our relationship as one in which we're going to demonstrate different things to each other to make the other one better. We must accept each other as equal in that relationship. You cannot have equality where there is fear. If I am afraid of my marriage partner, if I am afraid of my friend or what might happen if I were to reveal something, then we do not have intimacy. Intimacy requires equality and acceptance and lack of fear.
Now here is one place where we have some difference of agreement. I want to go up to the board and put something on here with some others who have written on the subject and discussed the subject of marriage in terms of the matter of equality. When our book first came out, there was a review in the Minneapolis paper, and Laurie Sturtevant stressed the fact that in our book we seek to stress equality. And a guy called up and he said he's very distressed and upset about this, and he asked, among other things, have you ever belonged to a Bible-believing church? And I said, yes, I think we belong to that. But there are people who belong to Bible-believing churches who don't take this perspective. Some of you have been to the Basic Youth Conflicts business with Bill Gothard. Many of you have probably read Larry Christensen's book on the Christian family. I have very high respect for Larry Christensen. He was a student at St. Olaf a couple of years ahead of me. Very capable, intelligent, wonderful guy. And so when I want to take a different point of view than he does on this particular matter, I don't want to suggest that I'm trying to put him down. But what he suggests, and some of you have seen this, and I'm not so great at the blackboard, he puts God up at the top, and then the husband, and then the wife, subservient to the husband. He draws a line something like this over here to the children, and the wife is kind of in a secondary sense then the one who also has responsibility for the children. It's this kind of a hierarchical setup. What we would prefer would be, of course, to put God as Lord of us all, and then put husband and wife as equal, and then put the children here, and even also put a little dotted line that goes around this way, that as the children get older, they move out of the parent-child relationship into an adult-adult relationship like this, and that sometimes, as we know it often happens, and you've had this experience for many of you, the time comes when the children assume the responsibility for parenting and caring for their parents. But the basic thing we want to stress here is the equality of husband and wife. And we think on the basis of very solid, conservative, biblical interpretation, there have been references to this today, there were some in the Bible study today and so on, there were discussion the other day about the Genesis 1, we are both created in the image of God, you've got equality from the beginning of the Bible. We don't think it's right for Larry Christensen to take the consequences of the fall into sin in Genesis 3 as being the pattern of the divine order. We think that equality is the divine order. Maybe next week we turn on a subject, if those of you here discuss much more detail about this, but in Ephesians, we don't say Ephesians 5, we don't think that has to be taken as a sexist passage. It talks about mutual submission, but even if you do want to take it as a sexist passage, then we should see it in the same way we see Ephesians 6, where it talks about slaves be obedient to your masters. We don't take that as a divine order. That's pastoral counsel in a slave society. Ephesians 5 is pastoral counsel in a male-dominant society. We don't think that's the basic pattern. We think the basic pattern, and here I want to just call your attention to the materials, is really in Galatians 3:28, that in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. You are one in Christ Jesus. And just recently I learned that there is in this world a press called Galatians 3:28 Press, a press by the name of that verse, with a whole list of materials. And among those materials are the things that Virginia Mollenkopf has done And we'll maybe get into some of this more next week, but if any of you want to look at this as resources, women, men in the Bible, the Bible, biblical basis for male-female equality, we'd be glad to share that with you. We think equality is essential for intimacy.
As we go on from that as kind of our basic thing, then it gets to the point of really the nitty-gritty. How do you live this in a marriage? I think, you know, it's very nice to say this, but I'm sure as many of you are aware, when you start with your ideas and try to implement them in your daily life, that's where the problems come. And I was visiting with Christine
Carlson
the other day. They just left the village yesterday. And Christine and Maury are married and they have a new child. And I was telling her how I really appreciated how much they were sharing, even at this very early time, the parenting of little Kai. And I said, you know, it's probably easier as you start out, if you can start out with this sharing, this real mutuality in all things in your marriage. But for those of us that might not have started out that way, when we were married 26 years ago now, there was a different feeling in society. At that time, I saw myself as marrying a pastor, and I had all kinds of things at the seminary and other places that I was given in terms of what a good pastor's wife should be. There was very little in terms of what Carol should be by herself. And I think it's important for those of you that are perhaps younger and starting out to think of sharing and equality in everything. For those of us that are older, it's never too late. Every day is a new day of grace. Every day is a new beginning. And if our life patterns are that we're living have not been equal in all things, now is a good time to start. And I think that one basic place is in decision making. Sometimes we fall into patterns of how we do things and we don't question them. We just go on living that way. And one area is decision making. I was talking with a group of young women a few years ago just on this whole basic thing in terms of who makes decisions in a family. And they all expressed, oh, well, we share in decision making, we discuss, we gather information, and we sit down and we evaluate it, all the things that go into decision making. But this one woman said, if we can't decide on something, then my husband has the final say. We have decided in our marriage that, you know, that's the way we're going to do things. Well, that sounded to me, you know, at that point, I thought, aha, you're in for trouble, honey. That's just the response that I felt within me. But I thought, well, I'm not going to say anything at this point. And I really didn't need to, because another young woman in that group said, oh, but wait a minute. You know, if you have agreed on that in the first place, then, you know, what is the sense of all of this leading up to that point? And she made the point that we were both created in the image of God. We were both created by God with our own abilities and talents. And simply because we get married, because we choose to share our life, to have an intimate relationship with someone else, does not negate what we are as individuals. If a woman does not get married, no one questions her right to make all kinds of decisions in her life. But because she's married, to assume that from there on her husband will make those decisions, I mean, it's rather ludicrous when you think about it. So I think in decision making, although it might be difficult, I'm not saying it's easy, that in decision making we should be equals. We should use all kinds of methods to arrive at a decision that we are both happy or can live with. We don't need to be happy with everything, but we can live with things, even if we don't get our own way. And I think that's important in decision making, that we use all means possible to come to a decision that we can both agree with, but it should be a joint. We should both be equal in making that decision.
One of the suggestions that we make in terms of going through that decision-making process is to think in terms of what's right and not in terms of who's right. And that that gets us beyond saying that the husband has the last word or the wife has the final word. It's what is the wisest word. That's such a simple thing to say. And yet think about that, whether it's the board of directors of General Motors or your church council back home or someplace else. If everybody sits around the table and says, we have to do it this way because it's my idea, then you have just tremendous potential for conflict. But if everybody sits around the room and says, what's the best idea? You know, what's right, not who's right, then you have potential for creative decision making. One other thing in terms of this equality business, and I say this now by way of a personal kind of confession, Carol and I have talked about this, worked on this a long time, and I think it is still true for me that many times when I'm vacuuming the rug or making the bed or doing something like that, I think that I'm helping Carol with her work. Ellen Goodman has written a beautiful piece on that about the helping husband. And I think that's something for us as husbands to really be aware of. And there's a certain kind of a self-righteousness in that and a maintenance of inequality when we think to do those things, to have the vacuum cleaner out there and going over the rug, that's really Carol's work. But see, going out and deciding what kind of car we should buy, that's my work. And that to get into those kind of a stereotype patterns is very easy, and to get out of them is very difficult. And I think we need to realize that those things are our mutual work, and we don't want to predetermine who should do what. We have each of us has individual interests and abilities and so on, and the person with the greatest interest and the greatest ability should no doubt take the lead in different areas and so on, but we don't think that should be predetermined just by our sexual difference.
I think it's important too, speaking as Lowell's wife in the situation, that for me, whenever Lowell does some of these things, in the beginning, it was difficult for me to not feel a sense of guilt in having him do some of this. I teach and am at school all day, and he's at the church doing his work, and many of the times his work would overlap into the evening more than mine. And it seems sometimes that, you know, if he were helping, I was thinking, oh, well, I have to be, you know, super whatever, super mom, super wife, everything, and that I felt guilty that because of his very holy calling, that he should have to take some time to do some of these mundane things. And it really is hard sometimes to work this kind of thing out in terms of how we can accept it, that I should accept it, that that's part of his responsibility in our relationship too. And it really is as you work through these things and as we accept this, that you build an intimacy in a relationship.
I want to, just before we leave this matter of equality, to underscore again that I think though we've had a lot of examples here for marriage, I think it does relate to other relationships as well, and especially think of that in terms of friendship. The same kind of thing we put on the board here about the relationship, kind of, it's the parent-adult-child kind of business that some of you are familiar with, and the transactional analysis and all that kind of thing, that it's difficult to have a relationship where you've got, whether it's a husband and wife or friends, whatever, one really has the parent role, one has the child role. We think if that's present, and there are times when all of us need to be in those, we need to play the kid or to play the parent or do that, but basically the relationship needs to be one of adult relationship, and if it isn't, then one of the steps, maybe one of the only things you can do about that is to talk about it, to confront the fact that there are these kind of feelings and to face them and deal with them. And that leads us into the next thing in terms of, we talk about the basic business of equality as essential to intimacy. The next thing, of course, in terms of a means of working toward and achieving intimacy has to do with the whole matter of communication.
And as we think about communication, I think we think back to when we talked about Jess Lehrer in terms of sharing what is deepest and closest to us. And a lot of us in our family relationships and in other, we're talking all the time. Talk is part of our communication. And we talk about a lot of things. It reminds me of a woman who came in one time and for counseling, or, you know, just to talk. And she said, you know, she says, I really have a wonderful husband. He loves me, he loves the children, he cares for us, he provides for us. And you know, you wonder, did she just come to tell us how wonderful her husband was? Well, she finally got, she said, there's only one thing. And the one thing was that he doesn't talk to me. I mean, he'll talk about, you know, pass the ketchup and, you know, what I did today and what did you do and where is it, who's taking the kids swimming. But he doesn't talk to me. He doesn't share what he's thinking about, what he's dreaming about. And I think what we want in an intimate relationship is that kind of sharing of what is deepest and closest to us. And why that doesn't happen is perhaps the thing that we'd like to talk about today. And why do we not share with those whom we should feel the closest and the most intimate?
One of the things that Ann Landers has suggested, and we put that in our little book too, is that you should marry a good friend. Some of you who aren't married may want to think about that. That's not everything in marriage. Many times I sit with couples and with people talking about these things. I'm very frank to say, I think you should marry someone you'd like to go to bed with. But I think you should also marry someone you'd like to get up with, someone you'd like to take a long trip in the car with. And one of the sad things in getting into marriage counseling is many times we sit with people who've had this very passionate kind of relationship and so on, and out in the moonlight and all that, and one day, a few months later, they sit across the breakfast table and look at each other, and if they're honest, they say, I don't like you. We really don't have a lot of things to talk about and to share. And so what we're dealing with here, again, is something that's very, very profound. And Carol's question, why don't we do these things? It relates to matters of mutual respect and common interest and fear of each other and all kinds of things that work in together. And that, maybe I'm getting ahead, I don't know where we are in our scratchy notes here, but I think too, another thing that, as we think about this sharing, and I thought of this when Carol talked about listening, I think of another situation of sitting with a couple in a counseling setting, and this woman was very, very angry at her husband, and she was just, you know, chewing him out up and down, and the counselor sits there not quite sure what you're supposed to do, and so I finally asked her in a pause in all this, you know, what are you really trying to tell him? And her mood changed immediately, and she began to cry, and through her tears she said, I just wish that once in his life he would take me in his arms and tell me that he loves me. Now, in back of that anger was a very lonely kind of person. Now, we can say, why didn't she do that? That's really the question that Carol asked. Why didn't she have that kind of openness and that kind of sharing? Well, I suppose if we think about it, we know she wished she didn't have to do that. If she would tell him, you know, I wish you'd take me in your arms, tell me that you love me, and then he comes home and takes her in his arms, says, I love you, and then she says, you're just doing that because I asked you to do it. But to get in back of these things, we want to talk in them, just go on here, to talk in terms of some maybe gimmicky kind of things even, of ways to have some breakthrough, that we can have the sharing of both positive and negative feelings.
I think it's important, one thing we talk about, if the communication, if for whatever reasons, I think sometimes communication breaks down when we really don't take each other seriously. Sometimes if you've ever shared something that's really important to you and the person that you're sharing it with just kind of treats it lightly, not realizing maybe how important it is. If you feel something, say you feel inadequate, I just don't feel I can do this well, and they pat you on the back and they say, oh, you can do it fine. Well, that really doesn't help. I had an experience that I think of very often when I was at St. Olaf. At that time, students would preach on Saturdays. If you were a senior student and you wished to preach, you could preach on Saturdays. And so I had signed up, and my day was coming up. I had been on the debate team at St. Olaf and had done a lot of talking. That's been part of our lifestyle, I guess.
We met on the debate team. We've only had one argument. We just take out time between the rebuttals to gather information.
But at that time, getting back to that, I had prepared what I was going to say, but I really was afraid. As I looked in my mind's eye out over that whole scene, I was afraid. And I went to one of the pastors there on the staff, and I told him how I felt. And I was sharing with him something, you know, that was frightening me, and it was really bothering me. And his words to me were, why, Carol, I'm surprised you, of all people, would come and say you were afraid to speak in chapel. Well, you know, if he thought that was going to make me feel good because he had confidence since I had done so much speaking, It really didn't. It did not meet my need at that time. And I think oftentimes in our relationships, perhaps instead of being so quick to say, oh no, you're really going to do that well or whatever, if we would just stop and listen and try to feel that even the person who seems most confident has times when they are not confident. And I think it means trying to understand, and lots of times that takes time. And I've got a circle around here. It says, take time. I think to build intimacy, we have to take time, whether it's with our children, whether it's with our marriage partner or a friend, to take time and to try to understand things that we might not understand. And that's important. I think it's, as we go on in terms of building relationships in our marriages, I think if we have trouble communicating, one way in which we can kind of, we mentioned this in the book, and it is kind of a gimmick, and we don't usually go for gimmicks, but sometimes if you recognize it as a gimmick, it maybe is, you acknowledge that and then use it as you can. But it's to just take a sheet of paper and write down, I like it when. You know, instead of dwelling on negative things, things that bother us, maybe we should just write down on a paper, each take a, you know, a sheet of paper sometime and just say, I like it when, and list, you know, a half a dozen things that you like that happen in your relationship. And then sit down together and read what you've written. You might find that some things are alike, but there might be other things that are different. And it's amazing how much easier it is to talk about something when it's written out here on a piece of paper than when you just sit sometimes and try to bring this subject up. You know, some subjects are touchy, and to just bring it up cold is difficult. But if you've just kind of done this just because someone said, why don't we try that? And you say, why don't we try that? And you try it, and there it is. It's out on the table in front of you, and you can really, oh, do you really like that? You know, it's a means of beginning, again, some communication on some basic things in a relationship.
I've been amazed many times in counseling with couples when we sit and talk about these things, and one of them will share something, this couple sit together, and the other will look at me, I never knew you felt that way.
And we think this could be a helpful thing to do. I wonder if that illustration they use about the woman who said, I wish you'd take me in your arms and tell me you'd love me, if in a situation like that, using this little I like it when game, when there wasn't a lot of pressure and, you know, you're just sharing things. She could have said that. They could have really begun something in their marriage that might have made a tremendous difference in their whole relationship. And so we encourage not only to do that as a little exercise, but of course beyond that, to get in the habit of sharing, you don't have to use those exact words, but sharing the things that we like and that we appreciate. And I think some of us Scandahoovian types are so reserved about that. We may not be quite as bad as that famous Norwegian who confided once to his friend, I love my wife so much I almost told her so once. Or another one, his wife complained to him, well, you never tell me you love me. And he said, well, when we first got married, I told you I loved you and I'd let you know if I changed my mind. You know, we don't live very well on last week's cold potatoes. And I think that's also true in our relationships. And we need that. One of us doesn't have to be, you know, cook up things or be phony. It is simply to be honest about the things. And this I like it when thing, that can be shared. You know, I like it when you put your dirty socks in the socks box. You know, I like it when you fix the carrots that way. Certainly in the physical, sexual intimacy of marriage, you can think of all kinds of things that I wouldn't dare say out loud, you know, I like it when. You can share with each other the things that you really find meaningful and beautiful for you. And that we think that that's one of the real keys in terms of building intimacy, is that kind of positive sharing.
But it's important, and we've talked about it before, in terms of how do you share the negative things. How do we share hostility without harming someone? You know, in Scripture it tells us to be angry, but do not sin.
It's a good verse, Ephesians 4:26.
And I think that as we look at this in our communication, it's important in a relationship, if it's to grow, that we communicate this. It's hard. We all know situations of people, you know, who go off into a pout, and you know something's wrong, but you don't know what's wrong. And I think it's important that we learn to share our negative feelings and our hostility with each other, too, in ways that are not damaging, but that are helpful.
One of the things we try to do with couples getting prepared for marriage, and I think this, again, is helpful in friendship relationships, too, is to ask people to talk with each other. That's a good conversation. Talk with each other about how your parents handle their hostility. What have been the patterns in your family? Some people have been used to the silent treatment. They, as Carol said, they climb, don't say anything. Other people are complete opposite extreme. They scream and holler and yell. And some people throw things. Some people walk away. Some go out and get drunk. I mean, they do all kinds of... It's a fascinating subject for conversation. And I think in a relationship where you seek to build intimacy, it's helpful to know where you come from, because those patterns aren't just back there in your parents. We catch them. Attitudes are contagious. And we have in us many, even things we don't like from our parents. We find ourselves reacting and responding in some of the same ways. And we don't think we have to be locked in to those kind of patterns in terms of dealing with our hostility and with these negative feelings.
I don't know how many of you are teachers, but in Minnesota a few years ago, it was required of all of us that we should have some human relations courses, and through taking one of those courses, it was this whole, I think it comes out of the parent effectiveness training and the teacher effectiveness training, some of those ways of dealing with communication. And the idea was that we share our negative feelings, we share our hostility in terms of explaining or saying how we feel. I feel hurt, I feel angry, not that you have done something to me. Instead of pointing the finger at Lowell and saying, you know, you're wrong, you make me angry, you do things the sloppily and all of this. Instead of saying that, I say, I'm disappointed when things are done in a certain way. I feel put down when you do this. We describe how we feel rather than attacking the other person. And in doing that, it makes it possible to really talk about what is the problem. I think in terms of with our kids, especially, our kids were in school and I was, while I was teaching, and the understanding was that I left before them in the morning and the dishes were supposed to at least get off the table and into the sink. When I think of how they do things at Holden, I think, boy, I really goofed. I wish that I had had that so organized as that. But anyway, I came home one day, the dishes were still, you know, on the table, the peanut butter jar was open, you can just imagine the scene. And I really jumped on the kids. That's what I did. And I said, you know, you don't have any respect for me. You know, you expect mother to do everything. You don't do things right. Why don't you do this? You can just imagine the worst kind of thing. Then, after having been in this class, I thought, well, I will try this. And I came home to a similar situation, and I just shared how I felt. I'm tired, which I was. And here's this mess in the kitchen, and before we have supper, this has got to be cleaned up. I really feel disappointed when I come home and find this. It doesn't make me feel like wanting to get supper ready. Well, you know, it really was amazing, because with that kind of a thing, the children then said, oh, gee, aw, you know, and then they right away started in, and together we got that mess cleaned up. And I don't mean to say that that never happened again, but just to show you that by not attacking them, they were able to come and we were able to talk about it. And I think if we can do that, if we can handle our own negative feelings about situations in our marriages by explaining or sharing how we feel, it leaves it open for our partner to maybe there's some other reason that they have for this situation coming up. But we can talk about it and not just fight about it.
We think these two things, this I like it when kind of statement, and then the other thing, you know, when we share positive things, we can certainly say you are statement, you're wonderful or you're terrific or whatever it is. But when we start sharing negative things, to share statements, not you are stupid or something like that, but instead to talk about ourselves, I am hurt, I am angry, really makes a tremendous difference. When, you know, you get, on the one hand, you got knocking your heads together. On the other hand, you have beginnings of communication and sharing with each other. We suggest in our little book that the three most important words in marriage are the words, I love you, the next three are thank you, honey, and the next three are I'm sorry, honey. And we think that part of this is a mood of confession. Paul Tournier says, confession is contagious. We confess, we share our feelings with each other instead of attacking the other person. There really is, we think, a price in pain to be paid for intimacy. It's painful and difficult to share these kind of things, but we think they can be shared if we share them as a confession of what's in our deepest heart. There's a story that is told, I think a true one, about a woman after the Second World War who had been on in the Nazi side, so to speak, and that she was recruited by Lutheran World Relief people to work, and somebody asked her in the interview, how can you now work with these people who so recently were your former enemies? And she replied, we meet at the place of tears. And I think often in terms of building intimacy, in situations of a marriage or friendship where there's real difficulty, when there's no place else to meet, it's often possible to meet at the place of tears. And there may be actual literal tears there, where there is sharing and there's hostility shared, that can really be the beginning of a new basis of an intimacy that is not just a superficial kind of everything's nice kind of thing, but where you really work through those kind of difficult times into a new closeness that was even closer and deeper than you experienced before. Another thing that is so basic, and we want to try to round this up now quickly as we can here, is we talked about equality in the beginning as being a basic thing and then communication as a means toward that. Another very basic thing in all of this, of course, is the matter of our trust of each other. And here, just to underscore, the trust is built by the people in whom we have it. That's very theologically sound. Luther talked about how that, you know, faith is born of the gospel. It's made possible by God's faithfulness and promises and love in Christ. And so also in our relationships. If I have to begin the morning and I say, I'm going to try real hard today to trust in Carol, you know right away there's something wrong. If I trust in Carol, it's because of the kind of person she has been in our relationship. She has created the trust that I have in her, and hopefully I've also created some trust that she has in me. And so when we think about marriage, we talk about a certain kind of openness in marriage. I hope that's come through. We, at the same time, think about the importance of faithfulness in marriage. And many times I say to couples and talk about these things, do everything you possibly can to make it as easy as possible for you to trust each other. That is really basic. I don't know if I got time to tell a little story here, but I think it fits a little bit at least. Some years ago now, actually, when I first came to Hope Church, I got a call early in the morning from the janitor who said, there's a frantic guy over here who has to see a pastor. Would you please hurry over here? So I got over there as quickly as I could, and I met this guy who was indeed really frantic. And anyway, he tells me this story that he's been going with his girl. He's been more than going with this girl. They've been living together half the time and so on. They each had their own apartment, but they were living together, and they've been having sexual relations. He talked about how he'd had sexual relations with all kinds of women. He was the great lover of the world and all this stuff. And when they began this relationship, he had insisted with her this relationship was going to be totally open. And that if he wanted to have a sexual relationship with somebody else, that was fine. And if she wanted that kind of relationship, that is fine too. And none of this old-fashioned puritanical stuff. So now what has happened? A distant relative of hers has come to town to visit, and he's staying at her apartment. Now there's no indication anything going on between them at all. He'd come to Minneapolis to see the IDS Tower and go to the zoo maybe, I don't know what. But this guy now, he's all shook up and worried that there might be something going on between them. And he's an intelligent guy. He says, I don't know what's going on here. I was the guy that advocated this kind of openness. I was the one that insisted she should be free to have sexual relations with anybody she wanted to, just as I could. And then he made a statement I've never forgotten. He said, I don't know what's going on. He said, I think I must be in love with that girl. Very interesting. When he loves her, when he cares for her, when she is a person and not a playmate, then this other kind of openness now is gone. Now faithfulness comes in, not something out of the Bible, but something inherent in that relationship. And that when we stress openness, and we think it's important to have a kind of openness in marriage where you don't just squelch each other and you have freedom, you have individuality, but at the same time that we have this basic faithfulness.
Kind of tying in with that, and as we kind of close too, that in seeking an intimate relationship, it does not mean that an intimate relationship is togetherness all the time. I think we've seen an awful lot of that, togetherness as families and as couples. And it's important that we do have times of togetherness, but it's also important that we have times alone and time to do things that perhaps we cannot share with our partner or with our friend. And I think that if we are going to grow, which I think is a basic part not only of all of life, but especially crucial in a marriage relationship, that each partner grows. If one grows and the other one, you know, has kind of an arrested development, that's really not very good for a relationship at all in any kind of a situation. But I think especially in marriage, as we are open for each other to grow, we have to be willing to grant each other that personal solitude, that personal life, and then seek to share that with each other. And I think it's important. We talked about this in the book, I think, and it's something that perhaps you've seen in terms of these marriage candles. And I think it's a nice part of a wedding if people like to have the two candles that are lit symbolizing the two persons, and then they light a marriage candle. And we have attended weddings where that has happened, and then where they have blown out the candles, the two individual candles. And I think that is blasphemy. I really do.
I never heard you put it quite that strong.
But I think...
Getting stronger.
I think it is important for us that we are still two individuals in a very special relationship. That is important. But we need to maintain that we are still individuals. And I think that in our marriage lives together, whether it's many different areas that we might not share in that intimate way with each other. And we should not expect that we have to share everything, that we have to each enjoy everything. I think if we can have basic sharing and intimacy, then we can allow each other that time of solitude, those areas that perhaps you don't enjoy together. And with trust and faithfulness, this can be carried out in many different ways. And I think that's important to marriage.
One other thing in relation to trust probably should be underscored, and that is that trust does not mean we make the other person into a god. That we have total trust in the human relationship, but we don't make a god of the person. Some years ago, I wrote a magazine article on paradoxes of living, and one of these paradoxes was, we live best with those we could live without. I remember getting into quite a discussion with one person, didn't like that at all, and I think I'll still try to stand by that. We live best with those we could live without. When we say, you know, if I'd said, Carol, I couldn't live without you, that's nice, and maybe I should say that sometimes, but I hope it really isn't true. I hope Carol could live without me. I hope that the relationship we have shared would make it possible for her to go on without me if that day came. I'm not God for her, that God is with her. And so when we think about faithfulness, I think it may be helpful for us to keep that also in mind.
We do want to allow a little time, and it's getting to be a precious little time, for you to respond and to question things. One thing, as we kind of close, Lowell and I are rather sentimental. I share that with you. That's not anything so terribly intimate, maybe, but our kids think that sometimes we even get sloppy sentimental. But it's important, I think, as we think about intimate relationships and what they mean for us, and how we should view them. Our son has just completed 2 years of chemotherapy, and he had an opportunity to speak at St. Olaf Chapel, and one of the things that he said, that this has given him new perspective on his life. And I think perhaps if we look at our marriages and look at our relationships, maybe we can have some new perspectives on them as to what is really important and basic in this kind of an intimate relationship. And to tie that in with the sentiment, then, are a couple of little poems that Lowell and I like. And we're going to kind of subject you to that little bit of sentiment.
I would like to just add one other word before we share the poems. And that is that in the context of all of this, we, of course, want to stress also the basic significance of the grace of God that makes each day a new beginning. I think it's Jim Merrill, who has said that he believes in the multiple honeymoon plan. And we sometimes talk about that with couples, too. When you say, have a big fight, and say, the honeymoon's over. Well, okay, now you plan a new honeymoon. And go on and having honeymoons over and over again. And if we had time, we could talk about all kinds of things. I've got a little speech maybe I should give somewhere around here on grace and sexual fulfillment and all these. But basic to all of this is the grace of God. And as we think about our whole life in the context of God's love and mercy and power toward us, we don't think it's just being sentimental for us to treasure the relationship we have, to treasure the time we have together. Some of you have been the last couple of nights meeting together talking about the experience of loneliness and living after loss and so on. These poems are a couple that we quote from a little book called The Lonely House. And the title of that I could mention is that our daughter, after my mother died, and my dad was living in the old farmhouse, and she said we should give the old house a name. And we said, what should we call it? We should call it The Lonely House, she said. We think about that, the shortness of life, and in relation to that, and the treasuring of the life we now have, here's my little poem, and then Carol will have one too. This is from Stephen Vincent Benet. It's significantly, I think, titled 35. The sun was hot, the sky was bright, and all July was overhead. I heard the locusts first that night. 6 weeks till frost, they said. 6 weeks till frost, that's the story of life and of death. And if we think of the great gift that God gives us, not only now in marriage, but in friendship and the kind of intimacy we can share, it's helpful for us to remember 6 weeks till frost. We have this time to share the joy and the beauty and the pain of this life together.
And because I had an in with the author, this poem got in here too. This is one that I learned as a very young person. and I think it has something to say to this whole situation too. Perhaps you know it. Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough and stands about the woodland ride, wearing white for Eastertide. Now of my 80 years and 10, 20 will not come again, and take from 70 springs a score, it only leaves me 50 more. And since to look at things in bloom, 50 springs are little room, about the woodlands I will go to see the cherry hung with snow. Now for some of us, according to this arithmetic, I don't have 50 springs. And yet I think if we can keep that perspective of our life in terms of our relationships, not only to enjoy the things that we appreciate in nature, but especially to really appreciate and enjoy the intimate relationships that we have with the people that are important in our life. Maybe then we can grow in grace too.
Thank you all, and may God help you to be good to each other.
And then...